Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. This is Alejandro Rojas, Alejandro Thaddeus Rojas to be precise, in case you were curious of my middle name. And I have with me Jason Jaime McClellan.
I am Jason Jaime McClellan and I am happy to be here.
Yeah, so your middle name really isn't Jaime, is I just made that up.
No, but we can make a new one every week.
Yeah. Do you want people to know your real one?
People who want to know can know and do know, but
how do they?
Because
do
you've run out of interesting and quirky names for me, I think now you can start playing with my middle name.
Yeah.
A new middle name every week.
Yeah, I haven't ran out. It's just fun to do a middle name.
I don't know. You did a lot of recycling there for a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, I could do like some. I haven't done like some Hispanic ones, like Pablo or Paquito.
I'm pretty sure you did those probably maybe 3 years ago now.
Really? Did I do Paquito Benito?
Probably.
Really?
I think the odds are pretty high that you have.
That one, if you know Spanish, is kind of a burn and a compliment all in one.
You got your bases covered.
Yep, exactly. All right, well, let's go on with the show. Today we have a wonderful guest. We have Kevin Randall, and he's a cool dude, I think. He actually used to be, is a retired lieutenant colonel. He served in Iraq as a helicopter pilot. He worked in battalion intelligence, and then he began writing science fiction. He's got an interesting story. I'll just talk about that now. What happened was, he was a science fiction author. He was asked to be part of a panel where they were going to debate UFOs. He was on the con side. However, they got too many people on the con side, and he decided, since he's a debater, he'll just, for the heck of it, go on to the pro side, and he really got into the topic, and now many, many books later, he's a major researcher in this field. And he's done a lot of research on Roswell and many other topics. And his new book has to do with government files. In fact, it's called The Government UFO Files, The Conspiracy of Cover-Up. So we're going to talk a little bit about, because he's had some opinions and research that he's done on the Majestic 12 Doty stuff. So we're going to talk about that. Hopefully you're not completely tired of it. If you are, we don't talk about it for too long. But we talk about that, and then we talk about his book and the government UFO files, which is, and it's a perfect segue from one topic to the other because, you know, we're talking about government files and conspiracy and cover-up. Bum, bum, bum. So a lot of fun. So we'll be talking to Kevin very soon here. However, before that, Jason Jaime McClellan and I like to talk about UFO news. So of the week. So let's go ahead and get into that.
Let's get into it indeed. Whoa. I am Jason McClellan, and here is my story for the week. Alejandro, I'm going to talk about the motorcycle story, because I think this is a really cool story.
Different.
So it is different. So we wrote about this, and it's an old encounter, an old UFO encounter, but it just made news last week, and this is about a 96-year-old man from Tennessee who recently retold the story of a UFO encounter he had in 1974. Now, this came out because the Knoxville News Sentinel, a newspaper there, publishes a monthly profile of people from East Tennessee who are at least 70 years old. And so last week they happened to profile a gentleman by the name of C.R. Klo. And this gentleman spent more than 20 years as a fire investigator and training in fire prevention. He was also a freelance photographer for more than 20 years. So part of this profile, he shared a UFO encounter that he had. He described that he had recently purchased a motorcycle, and he was driving down the road at approximately 10:30 at night. He was on his way to work, and he noticed a really bright light in the sky. And his motorcycle's engine just stopped. It just died. He was going 50 miles per hour down the road, and the engine just shut off. So he stopped. He continued to try to start the engine, and it wouldn't start. And he says that 15 to 20 seconds went by, the light disappeared, and as soon as the light disappeared, he was able to start his motorcycle and go on his way. But he is absolutely convinced that the magnetic field from this UFO disabled his motorcycle's engine, and we've heard that many times before in other cases, the electromagnetic interference from these unknown objects.
Yeah, pretty weird. And it's kind of fun because we had a UFO chasing guy on a motorcycle, at least a report not too long ago.
And that was, I believe that took place in 84 or 85, something like that. So,
yeah, really interesting. People love cases where there's a physical effect, and that's what happened in this case.
Yeah, so I really like it. It is an older story, but kind of fun thinking about this 96-year-old man talking, matter-of-fact, about a encounter with a UFO on his motorcycle.
Yeah, scary.
I dig it. Yeah, it would be pretty scary. He didn't seem too freaked out by it, but convinced that it was the UFO that disabled the motorcycle. Mm-hmm. So I do like these cases of electromagnetic interference. Don't hear a lot about them, but there are the occasional cases where we do.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
All right, well, what is your story, Alejandro?
Well, I got to do my little bit of cheating, as I do every
cheat.
Week.
Don't
I'm cheating.
Cheat.
You can't stop me.
Well, if you're going to cheat, I'm going to cheat.
Okay. You cheat first.
Do you want me to cheat first, or do you want to go me, then you, then me, then you?
No, I want you to cheat first.
All right. Well, I'm going to cheat. This is just a quick one I'll throw out there. And I'm only throwing this out there because I'm really excited about the fact that next week you and I will be heading to Roswell, New Mexico. And you'll be presenting some awesome lectures there. I'm really excited for those. But the Roswell, the UFO Museum there, the International UFO Museum and Research Center in downtown Roswell, New Mexico. If you've been to Roswell, you're very familiar with this. This is kind of the centerpiece in Roswell. They've made some changes. They put up new signs out front. They've got a new marquee coming that hasn't arrived yet. They're still waiting on it, but they promise it'll be ready by the time the festival rolls around, which is next week. So fingers crossed. But they're also adding some additions to the museum. They've added some movie props, one of which is a power loader from the movie Aliens. The other one, they've teased it a little bit, but they will be revealing it at the Roswell Festival. So we'll have to wait and see what that prop actually is. They also announced that they plan to add some touchscreen interactive things to their exhibits as well. That won't be done in time for the event this year, but it will be in place next year. They also plan to convert an empty lot nearby into a UFO park. So they're doing some moving and shaking there, which is nice because it does tend to get a little stagnant there with some of their stuff, but they do claim, even though their museum's kind of been under construction right now with the new signs and everything, that they're still averaging about 1,000 people per day.
Whoa.
And that's crazy, thinking about 1,000 people in Roswell, New Mexico, during a time when the Roswell Festival isn't taking place.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people. So if that is, in fact, the case, they're doing a pretty good business there at the Roswell UFO Museum.
Yeah. Well, and luckily they had a pretty good budget for this renovation because they were going to build a whole brand new building. They didn't get enough money to do that, so they're renovating what they got, which I think is cool, personally, because what they got is really neat. It's in the historic district. It's an old theater with the cool marquee. So I like where they're at. So I'm kind of happy that they were remodeling what they've got.
I do too, because for a while they were working on going to a new location, and it didn't really seem to be like a good, convenient location. It was away from where everything happened.
Away from downtown.
Yeah, they wanted to build this new, weird building. I'm glad they're staying. I'm glad they're updating what they have. And I'm sure Alejandro will mention this again at the end of the show, but just because we're talking about it, I'll remind people that the Roswell UFO Festival takes place July 3rd through 6th. Alejandro, Maureen, and I will all be there, so come say hello.
Well, and I'm doing a couple talks, but you are joining Aaron Sagers.
on Sunday, yes, at the Convention Center, to kind of do a roundtable discussion about UFO and alien movies, Hollywood movies, and how they've influenced pop culture and just kind of society's view of UFOs and extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm. Cool, cool.
Yep.
All right, thanks. That's going to be exciting, the July 4th weekend.
All right. So now go ahead and continue with your cheating.
Okay. Yeah, and the reason we call it cheating is because Jason and I are supposed to stick to one story, but we're so excited about UFO news that it's hard for us to do. And so I'm going to cheat just by mentioning a couple of our guest posts, which we have a ton of these days, which is a lot of fun. It's not just me and Jason writing with the occasional contribution from Maureen. So we have Paul Stonehill has written something about a Russian scientist where there's actually a reporter in Russia who's been looking at this guy's life because he was a student of his and found out he was really into UFOs and had a lot to do with some ancient alien research in Russia. So that's a really cool story. And then we also had another story from Stonehill, and actually I might have talked about this, but this was Pavel Popovich, cosmonaut, who is into UFOs. I think I did mention that one. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of cool. And then we had, of course, our other UFO sighting reports from Roger Marsh, some of them pretty interesting. In fact, we've got an ongoing investigation. So Roger last week wrote about two California UFO witnesses that were 10 miles apart who described similar strange lights. He told me that they've gotten a lot more reports at MUFON. Local guys are doing some investigation. This has actually hit the news, the local news now, mainstream news, but they feel that they've been able to uncover some things. So he'll be writing about that. Hopefully today we'll have a story up on that. So really exciting, some MUFON stuff. However, the story I wanted to talk about is we also got from Paul Stonehill. He just sent me this report from these Israeli UFO researchers. The name of their organization is the Israeli Extraterrestrials and UFO Research Organization. They had a member go to Romania, and this is actually the town where Dracula, well, Vlad the Impaler, who is the inspiration for Dracula, his birthplace, so kind of by extension the birthplace of Dracula, a town called Sigisoara. I don't know. I'm sure I got that wrong, but something similar to that. You can see it on the webpage. But in this old monastery, this person took a photo, and it's really interesting. There's this shield-shaped object with smoke coming out of it over the building. So it's very interesting. Now, this isn't the first time we've seen this sort of object. In fact, this sort of shield-looking object has been in artwork and on coins since the 4th century, but more largely in the 17th century when this is believed to have been painted. And our good old buddy Mark D'Antonio, who is the photo and video analyst for MUFON, has done some research on these shields. And what he discovered is that these shields are most likely shields. So actually he found that there are military shields, especially in France, in the 17th century, late 17th century, that look very much like the shields in the artwork. And we've got some pictures of that and some of the coins that you can see that in. In fact, one of these coins has this shield kind of taking arrows as if it's defending itself from arrows. He talks about how there's this kind of ray of light sometimes people see in the middle, but that's actually a metal piece that is attached to the shield used for deflecting arrows. So kind of interesting. He found that those are depictions of shields most likely. However, he says, you know, why are the shields flying in the air? Are they kind of like the painting has a little saying on the bottom which says, Israel, put your hope in the Lord. So is this a shield, kind of the Lord defending the people or something like that? Or is it something more mysterious? We don't know. But, of course, a lot of people like the UFOs and artwork, and we'll see if you're into that topic, the similar shape and appearance. And, you know, go and let us know what you think, because we'd love to hear what you think. Do you think it's something depicting a UFO, or do you think it's something more mundane? It's still a very pretty painting, And I haven't seen this. I mean, there's a lot of people who specialize in UFO artwork and these ancient chilled paintings and things and coins, but I haven't seen this one in the artwork, so this is a new one to add.
I hadn't seen this one either. It's pretty fascinating. I like the shape of it. Don't know why it's smoking. Maybe it got shot down.
Yeah. Shot down by Vlad the Impaler. He impaled the UFO, perhaps.
Or maybe the UFO was coming to attack, and the Lord did a lightning bolt, shot it down.
Ooh.
Like people, put your faith in the Lord, and he'll protect you from UFOs.
That's another one. Or, because this is in Dracula's hometown, maybe Dracula is part alien.
That is certainly possible. I can see that.
Yeah. Just like, you know, there are the rumors of Ninja Turtles having a new origins of being aliens. Maybe, you know, it's about time someone did a movie, because there's so many vampire movies of Dracula being an alien.
I just watched, for the second time, I believe, the theater production of Young Frankenstein.
Oh, that's right.
And Dracula makes an appearance in that.
Oh.
Because he comes and wants to buy Young Frankenstein's castle.
Uh-huh.
Pretty funny.
Yeah, sweet. Awesome. So if you're in Arizona or somewhere where that play is showing, you got to check it out, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a good play.
Yep. Good stuff.
Good stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, Alejandro, I compliment you on your cheating. You did a good job of cheating today and pointed out some important things. And that California story by Marsh, with the California sighting, is pretty interesting. And we've gotten so many comments about it, too. People saying, oh, I saw something similar, or my friends told me they saw it, and it just keeps coming in. So, developing story. I hope we have something new about that soon.
Yeah, we definitely will. So, some more information if you saw it, because it sounds like a lot of people saw this thing. So, if you saw that, you're going to want to check out our website, because we're going to have more information about what you might have seen, or at least you'll be able to read more reports of what others had seen. Exciting, huh?
Quite
exciting. Always something exciting at openminds.tv, your place for UFO news, and Jason Jaime McClellan.
But I'll have a different name next week.
Yeah. We'll see what it is. It's going to be a good one, though. All right. Well, without further ado, we should talk to this Kevin Randall guy, because he's fun to talk to. He's got a lot of very interesting things to say, so let's hear him out.
I am happy to welcome back to the show one of my favorite UFO researchers, Kevin Randall. Hello.
Hi, Alejandro. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I'm excited to see that you have a new book out.
I'm excited to have a new book out.
Yeah. What number book is this for you? You've written quite a few books now.
I have no clue. It's somewhere around 120, 122. I haven't counted lately.
122 books?
Yes.
Holy moly.
And ufologically speaking, Brad Steiger and I aren't sure who's written the most UFO books. I think it's him. He thinks it's me. But it's, you know, like 25 or something UFO books, with Nick Redfern making a real charge at us.
Yeah, he's got new ones coming out every other day, I think.
Yeah, looks like it. At least my books are longer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and no offense to Nick, but I also kind of like the subject of your books often better.
Well, I try to take a solid look at the evidence for the UFOs and try to look at the cases that present us with the best evidence for the reality of the extraterrestrial hypothesis, as opposed to some of the, what I think of as, well, the subsets of the UFO field, like cattle mutilations or abductions or crop circles or the men in black. I think of those as all sort of subsets of,
mm-hmm.
of UFOs, and I look more toward what I think of as kind of the mainstream.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, speculation and anecdotal information is a lot of fun. I think it's definitely worth reporting and writing about, and it's very interesting. But I think the longer you are in this field, or at least for many people, at least for myself, I love the real stuff you can get your hands around, you know, people looking for new evidence and real some more substantiated kind of material.
Well, the documentation is what I'm looking for. In the new book, Secrets of the Government, the UFO Government Files,
mm-hmm.
I was dealing strictly with documentation in cases that I could find good documentation for, which is not to say there isn't testimony from witnesses and that sort of thing, but I was looking for information that if I made a statement, you could go to the same sources and get the same information, so it was documented. It clearly wasn't something that was being invented by a witness or something that I was inventing, but it was something that you could follow my footsteps in and kind of verify, sort of a peer review type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I want to talk a lot about those files and what you found and what you wrote about, because, like I said, I'm really interested in those topics as well. And sort of related is, my pursuit to investigate the whole Doty Benowitz affair from that angle, looking at government documents and what those government documents had to say, because, and your work was important because I followed your work and what you had written about on this topic, and so it really helped lead me in certain directions. But a lot of that material, as you've noted, the hoax material, as well as the real government documents, has been overlooked in that case.
There's been a lot of stuff written about MJ-12 and how it came about, and searches for the authenticate the documents, which of course we needed to do. But when all of that has failed, we needed to move beyond it, and yet we still get caught in arguments about the reality of the original or the initial documents, overlooking the fact that there's really no provenance for them. There's nothing that I can FOIA. I can't go to the government and FOIA documents about MJ-12. Project Moondust, which is sort of the secret investigation that followed along, sometimes parallel with Blue Book and sometimes later, but a project out there for a sec,
I'm sorry. But
I was going to say, the Project Moondust stuff, which deals with part of the UFO phenomenon, if I go to the government and I FOIA the State Department or other places, I can get documents about Project Moondust.
Right.
And in fact, as I was going through the Project Blue Book files, I was looking for some specific cases in 1960, And as I was scanning through the microfilm, I thought I saw the words Moondust, so I stopped and went back, and I found four cases in the Project Blue Book files that talk about Project Moondust. So there's a provenance for the documents. We know this project existed because we found source documents that relate to it, but we have nothing like that for MJ-12 at all. Even after, 30 years of people looking for the stuff, we still haven't found anything.
Mm-hmm. And, I guess I'm curious about this. There are some people there is anecdotal information out there. Do you find any of that, when it comes to MJ-12, convincing?
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
We've known the name, Majestic 12. We've known it since the mid-1980s. But any FOIA request that is made, it comes back that we don't have any documents relating to this, or the documents are marked bogus, and the Air Force has said it's not true, the FBI has said it's not true. We do not know where the original documents came from. Well, actually, we can trace them back to one specific place, and we can get no further, and that doesn't help us authenticate the documents. So what we're left with is really a pile of rubbish that somehow has persisted since the mid-1980s.
Now, you pointed out a couple really interesting things that I didn't include in the video. There's so much there, but, they are really pertinent points. My audience has heard me talk about this case for the last couple of weeks since I released that video. I've talked about it on and on for a while. But you noted that when we're talking about the sources, when you go back to where they came from, that all roads lead back to Richard Doty, when he was working for the Air Force in their Office of Special Investigation, and Will Moore, who worked on a subject close to your heart, Roswell, and wrote the first book on that. And you note that, which is an important point, that Moore had talked about creating hoax documents.
Yes, he did. And you've cut out there briefly. Are you still there?
Still here.
Okay. More, according to what Stan Friedman told me, and we were on in California making videotapes of some of the witnesses there, such as Sappho Henderson, the wife of Pappy Henderson, who was involved in the Roswell case. And we're sitting there just chatting, and he told me that Bill Moore had mentioned to him that he wanted to create a Roswell-type document, that he'd run into a brick wall. He couldn't get any further, and he thought if he'd created this document, it'd be something to show the witnesses that would maybe induce them to tell everything that they knew, or might bring out other witnesses because this document had appeared. Stan denies the conversation ever took place, but I'm not alone on this. Bill Moore mentioned it to Brad Sparks. And Brad Sparks called for Stan and told him about it immediately, and that it was a really bad idea. And lo and behold, not too long after Bill Moore had made this suggestion, the documents show up at the home of his friend, a television producer, a movie producer, that nobody in the UFO field had ever heard of, with the MJ-12 document on it. And you have to ask yourself, you know, if I've got these documents and they're authentic, am I going to send them to some guy who isn't even prominent in the UFO field? If I've got the documents, I'm going to the New York Times or the Washington Post or CBS News and say, here are these documents, check them out. I'm not going to send them to some unknown producer in Hollywood who doesn't even have a role in the UFO field, and that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to look at that and you say, well, that sort of leads it back to Bill Moore. In that respect, he talked about doing it, and suddenly he's got the documents. But it goes even deeper than that. In 1980-81 era, Bill Moore was talking to Bob Pratt, and they were going to write a book about Project Aquarius, which is another name for MJ-12. But in the Project Aquarius book, you know, the MJ-12 stuff came up. The name Magic, code name Magic, came up, and Pratt detailed all this in his notes and whatnot that were reviewed by Brad Sparks and Barry Greenwood in an article that appeared in the MUFON Journal. So you've got this book that they wrote in 1980-1981 that sort of outlines the whole thing, and then suddenly, two or three years later, the documents show up alleging the same sort of thing, that there's this secret group named Majestic that's investigating UFOs, and you've got to ask, where did that come from? How did that originate? And it seems that the provenance of it is Bill Moore. There's nothing that goes beyond Bill Moore, Richard Doty, and Jamie Shandera. There's nothing that goes beyond them. You cannot go to a government source and find any information.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting is that Don Schmidt has contacted me lately. You two are prominent Roswell researchers, along with, of course, with Stan Friedman. But you and Don have similar views on this, and it seems to me that if Moore had made these documents, which I lean towards, he included Roswell in the details that him and Stanton worked on with Roswell in these documents. People point that it's awfully fishy that, you know, the details in his book are so familiar, similar to what's in MJ-12, the documents. But it seems like he would do that so that UFO researchers would go, oh, look, these are... we're being proven right because what we found is in these documents, and so they would fight for the veracity of the documents. But that's not true, which you know, speaks towards, you know, the integrity of you and Don Schmidt, for instance, in that you're going to look at everything and as objectively as possible, regardless of if it's kind of bolstering your argument.
But you also have to remember that the information in the MJ-12 documents reflects the state of ufology in the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the stuff in the 1990s and into the 21st century, we find out that a lot of the information included in the document is inaccurate. Stan has said repeatedly that when he saw the list of names, that this is who he would expect to be in the MJ-12, and that he and Bill Moore had done the research a decade earlier, learning who was where doing what in the government in 1947. So it made sense. The one name that was left out was Stuart Symington, and Symington was the Secretary of the Air Force at the time, or the Army Air Forces at the time. So he would have been in the chain of command as the information moved from Roswell to Fort Worth at 8th Air Force Headquarters up to SAC in Washington, D.C., where it was at the time, onto the civilian end of the investigation. So Symington's name should have been there, and it's not, which is something that I don't think anybody has addressed. Hmm. So we look at the documents and we say, this is the state of UFO research about Roswell and these things in the mid early to mid 1980s. It's not where we are today.
Mm-hmm. And then you made another really cool point that I was not aware of, but you found some similarity in documents that were copied.
Well, when the MJ-12 documents were released, it was Timothy Good in Great Britain who released them first. He got copies in the mail and he took them to the press, and they appear in his book in 1988, Above Top Secret. And on there, the evidence was really found by Barry Greenwood, so we should give him credit for this. Mm-hmm. But there's an artifact on the documents that is a result of the copy machine that was being used. It's not something that was picked up from the film, which is where the documents originated, or something else. It's an artifact of the machine, and it floats in from page to page to page. So it's a chevron type thing, three sort of chevron type shapes that you can identify, almost as unique as a fingerprint. And they're on the copies that Good has, and you can see from page to page where that artifact shows up. It's a floating artifact, so it's clearly from the machine. But it's also on some of the copies of the MJ-12 document that Bill Moore has. So it's clear that the documents that Good had must have come from Bill Moore, because it's copied on the same machine that Moore had, was using to make copies. And Moore could make all the copies he wanted from the film, because he and Jamie Chandra have the film in their possession. So they could make, you know, original copies until they got tired of it. But the Xerox copies that were made, they were made on the same machine, and Moore has copies of it, and Good has copies of it. So you can't say that Good's copies of the it came from a separate source. They actually are traceable back to Bill Moore and the copy machine that he was using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting, and I hadn't read that anywhere. Did he put that in a book somewhere?
Barry Greenwood has published that in a couple of places, and I think it may have appeared in Just Cause at one point.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that you have to remember about the Eisenhower briefing document, there's a case in there that they reference that's a complete and total hoax, and we didn't know about this case until 1968. So, you know, if the document was created in 1952, how did they get that information, this hoax information, in there? And that's what I say when I said it was the state of ufology in the mid-1980s. We believe this Del Rio case, this case from December 5th, 1950, of another crash. There's one paragraph about it, but it's all linked back to a guy named Robert Willingham, who claimed to have been a retired Air Force colonel, very high-ranking officer, who'd been a fighter pilot and had seen the thing crash, originally told Len Stringfield in 1948. I found the original story about it from the Skylook, which was the MUFON Journal's forerunner, from March of 1968. So you can go back to the March 1968 MUFON Journals, and you can find on page 3 this paragraph about Robert Willingham, who is a Civil Air Patrol officer, the Civil Air Patrol being a civilian organization, an auxiliary of the Air Force, but it has no official, well, it's a civilian organization is what it is. And they're engaged in search and rescue, and they're engaged in training programs for the youth of the nation type thing. But they're not part of the Air Force. They don't get paid for their services. They don't earn retirement points. So in this article, it talks about how Willingham was a lieutenant colonel in the Civil Air Patrol, and he'd seen this crash back in 1948, and it involved three objects, and he was flying F-94s. Well, the F-94 was not operational in 1948, and he's since changed the story to a single object, which fell at Del Rio. But the point is, this stuff is something Willingham made up,
mm-hmm.
and it appears in the MJ-12 document. In the mid-1980s, we all believed it because we thought Willingham was a high-ranking Air Force officer. That's what we'd been told, and we said his records had been checked. I finally went and checked the records myself and found that he had been a low-ranking enlisted man, an E-4, like a corporal, from December of 1945 to January of 1947. So he's been in service about 13, 14 months total. He's technically a veteran of World War II, even though he ended the service after the war was over. The war wasn't declared officially over until 1946, So if you served in that time frame after all the fighting stopped, you're still considered a veteran of World War II. And so he's now, we found out he wasn't a high-ranking officer. He couldn't have been a fighter pilot because he didn't go to flight school at the right time. He's changed the date three times. He's changed the number of aircraft. He's changed all kinds of things. So the story's a hoax. So you have to ask yourself, wouldn't the guys who were preparing the briefing for President Eisenhower have known that that story was a hoax if it had been circulating in the early 1950s, but it wasn't?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't come out until 1968. So the next question is, how is a case that wasn't invented until 1968 find its way into a document that was supposedly created in 1952? To me, this is the smoking gun. I mean, here's a paragraph that's clearly bogus. Clearly the information does not fit, although we believed it in the mid-1980s. So when it came out, it sort of underscored this idea. But we can look at documentation from Lynn Stringfield and other things that have been said about this specific case and see how it's evolved over the years as information came forward and we understood more about those sorts of things, how it evolved to try to make it more accurate. So that right there kind of eliminates the Eisenhower briefing document from this whole thing. And if that goes down, then you've got nothing left for MJ-12.
Now, I want to ask you a question I get asked a lot, because really, I think that's most likely the case that Doty and Moore created these. So it's kind of my null hypothesis, because I'm trying to disprove it. I have not been able to. But a lot of people ask me, well, why would they have done it? Why would these guys have perpetrated such an elaborate hoax that obviously took a lot of time?
Because it brought the spotlight to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you look at the people, the notorious hoaxers in the world, there's a number of motivations. One of them is financial gain. One of them is to make other people look stupid. And the third one is to draw the spotlight to them. And so you've got them coming out with these documents that purportedly show the U.S. government has been investigating the UFO crash since 1947, that they have the evidence, and it verifies what Moore wrote in the book, The Roswell Incident. It verifies all of that stuff and makes that a much more important work if the document is authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the reasons that they did, well, the reason they did it was partially financial, but I think mostly it was to sort of validate their work and bring the spotlight back to them. They got fooled by Good when they gave copies of the document to him, because he went immediately to the press with them, and so they suddenly are now in the unenviable position of something they created to bring the spotlight to them is now shining that spotlight on somebody else. But they quickly called their own press conference and started talking about that stuff as well. So it's been a way of them, or for Moore at least, to draw the spotlight back to himself for a number of years, until he went to Las Vegas in 1989 to the MUFON convention there and said, yes, I'm an agent of disinformation, and kind of annoyed everybody in the UFO field.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you this, because, you know, we talk a lot about Doty and Moore and Shandera, but of course Stanton Friedman was one of their partners back then. Some people have suggested that Stanton Friedman was part of this hoax. Do you believe that?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I think Moore created the documents for his own purposes. He shared them with Stan. They had been looking for the government, but I think Stan was fooled like the rest of us when the documents first came out. I mean, I know when I first learned of the documents, I thought, this is really great stuff. This kind of proves the extraterrestrial hypothesis. We're good to go here. And as we looked into it deeper, and when I say we, Don Schmidt and I, when we were conducting our investigation, and as I continued on, as we looked into it deeper, we could not find any evidence to authenticate it. I cannot FOIA anything. It all comes back to that 35-millimeter film that Moore got, or Shandera got in the mail, and the story that Doty told to Linda Moulton Howe, which kind of verified some of this stuff. And when I was doing the research for the book I did on case MJ-12, I was looking at that, and Doty was saying that the Kingman crash was real too, and I thought, how could you believe that? It's a single source and sort of evolved into a second source, but the evidence is that the Kingman crash never took place. So you've got Doty talking about all these different crashes that we've heard about and have been pretty well debunked, giving the information to Linda Howe, including the Roswell case and some other things there. So you've got it evolving from Doty to Linda Howe, Linda Howe being innocent in this as well. She was just gathering information, and that's what they told her. And you've got the same thing with Stan Friedman, gathering information, and they told him, you know, this is what we've got, and Stan took it and ran with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you with Stanton and Linda Howe, that, you know, they certainly had nothing to do with any hoaxing. But my last question before we move on to your book is then, something I found shocking, which was hard for me to understand until I kind of looked at this, and I'd like to hear why you think it's happened. There's been a few people. I mean, Timothy Good told me he doesn't believe MJ-12 documents are real or MJ-12 is real, but he doesn't say that very much. I mean, I don't think he's always said that. I know Tim Cooper, who received a lot of the documents, has said also that he thinks they're probably hoaxed. So the people who received them think they're hoaxed. Otherwise, you, Robert Hastings, Brad Sparks, to some degree, have been trumpeting, you know, all of this evidence that shows that these are dubious. And I know Stanton's had some misgivings when it comes to William Moore. But why do you think, because the vast majority, a lot of our colleagues, a lot of UFO researchers still tout the reality of MJ-12, and they seem to gloss over, ignore, or be ignorant of all of these things we just talked about?
We can take it to the other side of the coin and look at the debunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got a good, solid UFO case with multiple chains of evidence, be whatever it is, you know, the testimony, photographs, radar tracings, whatever, landing traces, whatever it might be, you've got a good solid case, and they ignore that evidence and come up with some little weak thing like, well, the witness said the object was in sight for 3 minutes and then later said it was 4 minutes. Well, clearly it's a hoax. So they gloss over the facts of the case. And I think it's all sort of a will to believe or a will to disbelieve. You know, the people who are still holding on to the MJ-12 documents aren't looking at the evidence that suggests they're hoaxes. They're looking for the validation that they get for their belief structures from the MJ-12 documents. They want something solid that says, yes, this is extraterrestrial. That sort of evidence exists in other arenas. When you look at this, and when we get to my book, I'll explain what I mean there a little bit better. But I think it's their the validation of their belief structure. And I run into this when people question me about certain things. They're not looking for an answer to the question. They're looking for validation of their belief structures.
Mm-hmm.
So if you give them the answer they don't like, then they ignore what you've said, and they go to the next person and ask that person the same question, and they continue it. And we see this a lot of times, asking the same question over and over until you get the answer you want and ignoring all the other stuff that came about earlier that suggests that maybe what you're looking at isn't true.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because a lot of people allude to the beginning of the MJ-12 documents to be the Shandera documents, which, you know, to begin with have questionable
Well, the actual beginning document was the Aquarius telex.
Right, exactly, and people don't ignore that.
I mean, ignore that, and I asked both Stan Friedman and Ryan Wood about it, and Stan said to me that he doesn't even mention it in his book, and yet here's a document that the first mention of MJ-12, and Bill Moore admitted that he retyped the document.
Right.
He said it was so poor that you couldn't really read it, so he retyped it, and then he put on the proper heading so it looked like an official document. He admitted that to Dick Hall a number of years ago. So we've got the very first document that ever mentioned MJ-12 being an admitted hoax.
Right, exactly. So, all very unfortunate affairs. So, thank you so much for sharing. And, you know, I'm grateful that you keep harping on these points because they're extremely important points that people keep brushing under the rug.
Yeah, they just ignore it because it's not what they want to believe. So, we'll just do something else.
Mm-hmm. getting to your book, The Government UFO Files, The Conspiracy of Cover-Up, one of the things I know that used to frustrate my colleague Antonio Huneas is that people always say the U.S. government hasn't released any UFO files. A lot of people keep saying this. Even, you know, major people in this field keep saying that, which isn't true. I mean, you've got a book that's full of files here.
But it's from a lot of different sources.
Uh-huh.
And so there's not some of the other governments that have released UFO information have done it in a single report or a single document.
Mm-hmm.
And with the U.S. government, the Project Blue Book files are all available now. Some of them are online. They don't have the whole set online. I've got a whole set of the microfilms. It's like 96 rolls of microfilms, and it's some 12,000 sightings and 50 or 60,000 documents. And those haven't been well researched yet. And as I said, you know, I was looking for a case in the late 1960s, and as I was scanning by, I saw the word moon dust, and I stopped and looked at the cases. Now, the cases are really crappy cases. It's something seen in the distance for like a second or two, and clearly could be a meteor or something of that nature, but they're labeled moon dust. And that's an important point. You know, we didn't know that any of this stuff was in the Project Blue Book files until I blundered across it looking for something else. I also found a document in the Blue Book files that gives us a date for the beginning of moon dust, because that always been an item of speculation. And in this letter dated of December 1957, it said the recently created Project Moon Dust. And the idea that it was created after the launch of Sputnik 1, because the mission of moon dust was to examine cases of returning space debris of foreign manufacture or unknown origin. So the unknown origin, of course, is UFOs, and we find other documents that bring moon dust into UFOs. So there's an awful lot of documentation out there, and there's files from the FBI, there's files that come from the NSA, there's all kinds of things, but it's so piecemeal it's hard to relate everything together. And what the one thing I found something that actually puts everything together. If you take a look at the Foo Fighters from World War II, you know, the a lot of times just balls of light seen in the sky, but the intelligence community on the Allied side was extremely worried about these, thinking they might be a German weapon or a Japanese weapon that would be of great destruction of our forces, our air forces. But there was a guy that was involved in the investigation of this named Howard McCoy. He was an Army Air Forces officer, and when they began the investigation of the Foo Fighters, he was directly involved in this. When the war ended, nobody cared what happened to the Foo Fighters, because clearly it wasn't a German weapon, it wasn't a Japanese weapon, it wasn't something of ours, but the war was over, so who cares? But in 1946, a year later, we start having the ghost rockets over Scandinavia. And the belief at the time was that it was some kind of a Soviet attempt to intimidate the Scandinavians, the Finns and the Swedes, by firing German V-1 weapons over them as sort of a test. And that was kind of a conclusion. We now know with the collapse of the Soviet Union that's not true, so there is no good explanation for the ghost rockets. But one of the guys involved in the American end of the investigation was a fellow named Howard McCoy. In December of 1946, before the Ken Arnold sighting, before any of official U.S. government investigations of UFOs began, McCoy is asked with another fella to set up a investigation of these unusual aerial phenomenon, these things going on in the sky. So they've set up an unofficial investigation at Wright Field. I think it was in a single room, and they kept the door locked and wouldn't let people in, but they're gathering all this ghost rocket material, and they're beginning to gather material of flying disc. There was a sighting in Virginia in March of 1947 where a weather guy was talking about seeing these disc-shaped objects and that sort of thing, reported to his superiors. That information got to McCoy in his locked room, so that when the Arnold sighting happened, we've already got an investigation in place. It's an unofficial investigation, but McCoy is running the investigation, so he's gathering that information. In July, a guy named Brigadier General George Shulgin wanted to get an idea of what was happening, and they put together what they called an estimate of the situation, not the one that we talk about earlier or much later, the bigger one, but a little estimate of the situation. There's 18 cases in it, UFO cases, some of them predating Arnold. Arnold, I think, is the fifth case in it. But they provide all that information to the Air Materiel Command and ask for an analysis of the information. And that resulted in a letter signed by Nathan Twining that said the phenomenon being discussed is something real and not illusionary and fictitious, and that, you know, the objects are metallic, they're disc-shaped, they have a dome on top, things of that thing. This is in the response that Twining signed, but Twining didn't write it. The guy who wrote the response, Howard McCoy. So we've got the same guy going from Foo Fighters to ghost rockets to the flying discs to writing the letter for Twining to sign about what these things are, which began the investigation Project Sign, the official investigation Project Sign, in January of 1948. So we've got it all connected together. So it doesn't begin with Arnold in June of 1947. It begins much earlier with that. We've got the same guys doing the investigations up through the late 1940s.
That's really interesting, and it's frustrating because even this week there's been some articles. The mainstream seems to be stuck on this idea that the UFO phenomena started with Kenneth Arnold, and a lot of them try to say that the Kenneth Arnold sighting happened and everything else after that is copycat, when there was a lot going on prior to Kenneth Arnold.
Well, absolutely. I was trying to find documentation for sightings of flying discs pre-Arnold in just the weeks before Arnold, and I failed to do that other than this case from Richmond, Virginia. But here's the interesting thing. McCoy knows about that case, but it's not in the Project Blue Book files.
Hmm.
You go to the Grudge Report, which is, of course, there was Project Sign, which they ended supposedly, but it changed the name and kept going, and then it was Project Grudge, which they supposedly ended, and then became Project Blue Book. But in the Grudge Report, there's references to that case. So we find references to cases in the documentation, but we don't have the case files themselves. So we can find some evidence of disc-shaped objects prior to Arnold, and included in that is some of the Foo Fighter stuff talks about disc-shaped objects, solid objects, not just balls of light. So that whole thing, you know, again, it's all Howard McCoy and that sort of thing. We can find disc-shaped objects earlier. The first use of the term saucer in relation to UFOs was from Texas in 1878.
Wow.
So the guy was saying it was about the guy said it was about the size of a saucer in the sky when he saw this thing. It's a guy named Martin, I think it was. So the use of a saucer kind of to describe either the motion as Arnold did or the size of the thing, you know, that goes back deep into the history of UFOs. So we can find those sorts of reference. So Arnold talking about being a saucer, and once that connection was made about these things being flying saucers, it didn't matter what shape was described by the witness. It was called a flying saucer or flying disc by the press. And you've got cigar-shaped objects and ball-shaped objects and all kinds of different shapes and things, but they're all called flying saucers or flying discs. So it's really not a fair criticism by the skeptics.
Mm-hmm. That's what's cool. I luckily found, I've been using Fold 3, and they've got all the Blue Book files, and like you said, there's tens of thousands, so I wish I could go download all of them, but there's so many of them. But I get fascinated, and for the magazine I was writing some articles, but there are so many incredible cases. I mean, this phenomena has been so well documented, and it's just all hidden in these government files.
And the problem we have in research is, you know, sitting in a library reading these documents isn't considered as sexy as going out and investigating an abduction or going out to look at a crop circle or looking at these sort of things. That's really exciting stuff to do because you're out investigating. You're not sitting in a damn library somewhere pulling these documents together, reading page after page of really boring, poorly written reports. But you come up with gems. And like I said, one of the gems I came up with was finding moon dust referenced in the Project Blue Book files. You know, those gems are there, but you find them so infrequently it doesn't reinforce the idea this is where we might be. Maybe we should be focusing more of our research.
Mm-hmm. You, in your description, you talk about that you touch on the topic of Men in Black. Did you find those sort of reports?
There are some Men in Black reports, but I really don't get into that into the book because by the time I got to that, the book was so big, we didn't do a lot of work on the Men in Black. But there are some interesting reports where people are reporting the Men in Black phenomenon. When I talked to John Keel about this in the late 1960s and asked him about the Men in Black, he told me that that phenomenon was reflective, which meant that the more you became interested in it, the more it seemed to gather around you. I did look at Nick Redfern's book on it, which I found absolutely fascinating, and so there's some stuff in that. But the Men in Black seem to be more of a paranormal phenomenon as opposed to a UFO phenomenon. So, you know, it's kind of a weird it's one of the subsets of UFOs that people talk about. I myself have not really had any experiences with Men in Black, and you know, people ask me, well, with your military career, has your interest in UFOs ever inhibited your career? And the answer is no. When I needed top secret clearances for my jobs, I always got it. Even though when the Air Force knew I was writing these articles about UFOs and were critical of the Air Force investigation, it didn't really stop the approval of my top secret clearances.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't had any problem. What does that lead you to believe then about a cover-up?
Clearly there's a cover-up, and the Condon report, you know, the University of Colorado study that looked at this thing, they said, well, we found no evidence of secrecy. Well, you go to the Project Blue Book files, and in case after case is marked secret. Well, that's pretty convincing evidence of secrecy.
Yeah.
But you look at the regulations, and it says if there's a plausible explanation for the case, then you're free to talk about it. But if you have no identification, you can't say, well, this is, you know, a weather balloon, or this was Venus, or this was an aircraft, or whatever, then it's considered classified, and you're not allowed to talk about it. Well, there's evidence of secrecy right there in the Air Force regulations to deal with it. And in fact, when the sightings were going on at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1968, when the Air Force, where the Condon Committee was investigating UFOs, their investigator was sent to talk to Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Chase, being the UFO officer on the base, and they sent him sent the specific investigator because he had a clearance to get some of the secret stuff. But Chase told him, I can't get into certain aspects of it because it impacts national security. And that was the shutdown of the missiles, which would be a national security item. So we know, so they ran into the secrecy themselves and said, well, we found no evidence of secrecy. Well, Chase said, I can't talk to you about that because it's classified. I mean, there's evidence of secrecy.
Mm-hmm. So if there's no MJ-12, who's keeping the secrets and why?
I think it comes broadly under the heading that used to be Project Moondust. Mm-hmm. After Blue Book closed and Moondust was running it, and we've got General Bollinger saying that, you know, cases that infect national security are not part of the Blue Book system. What system were they part of? Well, I think it was Project Moondust. But Moondust was compromised in 1985. We learned the name Moondust because Robert Todd had FOIA'd a bunch of documents from the State Department, and they didn't redact them properly, so the name Moondust appeared. The name's compromised, and when Todd attempted to learn the new name, he was told that the new name was properly classified. So we know that a project investigating UFOs or dealing with UFOs that wasn't an Air Force-run operation is still going on after 1985 under a code name that we have not discovered yet.
Mm-hmm. And who's running the project then?
It's got to be in the bureaucracy, because it has got to transcend the various political administrations. So it's some kind of a bureaucratic group at a very high level running the thing. But and it's probably a fairly small group because you don't want the secrets out. But mm-hmm. but it's something that we haven't beneficially discovered, and that may be the interest of MJ-12 or why some people believe it, because we can put a name on the group and say, well, it's the Majestic 12 group. And so that may be another reason that people want to hold on to the Majestic 12, simply because it allows them to put a name to this group, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, I mean, that there are a lot of people who don't know this group exists. Do you think, like, you know, there are all the generals or admirals or even the president are aware that this group exists?
No, I think it's a very small group, and there's some people at very high levels who know about it. Does a president know about it? I don't think so, and the answer is why not? Because he's got other things to worry about. You know, the UFOs aren't posing a threat to national security. They're not threatening the nation in any way. He's got to deal with a lot of stuff going on that has a higher priority. There was something called Operation Solo, and this was a guy. In the 1930s, he was a dedicated communist. He was very high in the American Communist Party, may have been the leader. And he was courted by the Soviets. He became disillusioned with it when he saw how the communist system was perverted by the Soviet Union, and became an informant for the FBI. But the Soviets trusted him at the highest level. Now, this was an operation run out of the New York FBI office. And you can document, there's a book called Operation Solo by John Barron. And it lays the whole thing out, and it wasn't published until after the guy retired, and he may have been dead when they finally published it, so there could be no retribution. But he was treated with great respect by the Soviets. The operations run out of the New York office. Not everybody in the New York office knew what was going on, and the presidents didn't know what was going on. The only time they felt compelled to tell a president was when right after Gerry Ford had become president, he was going to meet with the Soviet leaders, and he was concerned about how this meeting would go, and so they revealed Operation Solo to him and gave him some of the information about it. I think Kennedy knew about it because he pushed the Soviet Union, because he knew that the Soviet missile defenses and everything were not as great as they suspected, and it was Operation Solo that told him that stuff. So Kennedy pushed the Soviets a lot harder than he would have had he not had that information. I think it's all part of the package. But what this demonstrates is that there's stuff going on in the government that the president doesn't know, because he doesn't have to have a specific role in it. If something were to happen involving UFOs and he had to know something, well, of course he'd be briefed. And he could find out if he wanted to, if he knew who to ask and he knew where to go. And he may not even know that stuff, because it may be like this Operation Solo. You know, Gerry Ford wouldn't have known to go to the FBI office in New York and say, hey, what can you tell me about a mole in the Soviet hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's where we are with UFOs.
Uh-huh. So, Bill Clinton has said this several times, but he was on Jimmy Kimmel recently, and Jimmy Kimmel said, did you look into UFOs? And he says, actually, and he never shies away from saying, and he gets real humble and says, yeah, I did. Do you think then he did inquire if a group like this exists, and do you think they told him?
I think he inquired about Roswell, and I think he learned the truth. But because if you go back and you watch the Jimmy Kimmel interview, and Kimmel asks him about aliens, and he sort of says, no, not really, but he never really answers the question. He dodges the question, and Kimmel, being an entertainer as opposed to a journalist,
right,
doesn't follow up and kind of pin him down on it, but Clinton kind of makes a joke out of it and moves on without ever really answering the question. And I thought that was kind of significant, because if he knew there wasn't anything to it, I think he'd have been more definitive in his answer. And the fact that he knew there was something to it, he was careful what he said, because he just didn't want to be called out as a liar on this specific thing. So he was very careful, but he never really answered the question. And I did a blog piece on that right after it happened and pointed that out, that, you know, here's what was said, here's how it transpired, and he really doesn't answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was going to say, but Clinton or any president, I think he's got the power to find this stuff, because you're the president and you know, you got a bureaucrat there. You can say, well, what's the, you know, I ask you this question. He said, well, I can't tell you, Mr. President. And my answer to him is, well, you're fired. Bring your deputy in, and we'll see if he can answer my question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, Ben Hansen, I think you might have seen, did this interesting analysis on that whole Kimmel interview. I'm not sure if you saw that, but he...
No, I did not.
Yeah, you might want to see, he applied law enforcement, you know, tactics to tell if he's telling the truth. I think you'll find it's interesting. I'll send you the link, but two quick questions. Then,
yes.
In your book, when you were researching this, did you find evidence or any documents alluding to what you feel is another credible UFO crash besides Roswell?
No, not in the documents per se. I mean, there's Sag Harbor, of course, which I think is very, very credible, and things like that. I found in the documentation allusions to other crashes. Most of them are hoaxes, but I found some that said, well, here's this case. There was one in Mexico, I think, in October of 1947, that there's some discussion about it, but there's never any really real follow-up. I think I was able to get other information from newspaper sources that suggested it may have been a meteor that fell as opposed to a crash. But there are some references to these sorts of things, but they really don't go anywhere. In fact, I just did one on my blog that I'd come across. It's sort of between two cases. It's not really a case file. It's a letter sent by a guy alluding to something like that. And I put something up on the blog hoping that someone who lived in the area of Pennsylvania might be able to research the newspapers and get a little more information. But it was something that happened in the 1950s, and the letter was written in 1957. So, there are things like that. And when I find them, I try to put them up on the blog or publicize them in the hopes that somebody else living in the area will take the time to go to see if they can find anything more on it. And that's worked a couple of times for me.
And then finally, do you feel, I guess, with all these documents you researched and that you cited in your interviews, do you feel your book then makes a very strong case that there is a cover-up?
Yeah. I think we make a strong case that there's alien visitation based on the documentation and the way things are going, and there's a very good case of the cover-up. And again, it relates to Howard McCoy and how he answered questions and what was going on. And then you look at the Blue Book files and some of the preposterous explanations they've handed down. The Portage County case, which I think is the close encounters chasing of the police officers chasing the things across the landscape. In the Project Blue Book files, they said, well, it was a satellite and Venus, and you see that the guy, they first saw the object in the west, which means it wasn't Venus, given that Venus was a morning star at the time. And so they said, well, it was a satellite, Echo 1 or Echo 2. But right in the files, they've got a letter from a number of organizations that says, no, Echo 1 and Echo 2, the satellites, were over the southern hemisphere at the time. You couldn't see them from Ohio at the time the case took place. They could find no satellite that would have been visible. But the Air Force file says has got it labeled as a satellite for the beginning of the sightings. That, to me, smacks a cover-up.
Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, a Portage, Ohio case that's real famous, where cops were chasing UFOs and was seemingly the inspiration for the scene at the beginning of Close Encounters, the movie.
Yes, 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 the Portage County case. And the other interesting thing I found out, that three of the police officers, within months, two of them were no longer police officers, and the third one had been fairly well traumatized by the whole experience. So, it's not without ramifications. If you see a UFO and you report it, then there's all these ancillary things that go on as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, great. Super, super interesting. I mean, I love your work. I love this sort of thing. I love the files. I mean, I got to tell people that what is in these government files is gold. It's so incredible.
And we try. I try to document everything so that this case interests you. I tell you where you can find information of it that comes from an independent source. It's not just me or my interpretations. You can go back to the original documents and look at them yourself and decide whether or not you believe that my interpretation to be accurate, or if this is evidence of alien visitation.
Which I think is extremely important. First of all, it's important because then the people have a third party, another source. They have your source where you came from, so they could see if they agree with your interpretation. But beyond that, it's important for mainstream so they can see that you're not just using anecdotal data or pulling this out of the air, that it's documented in government files.
Yeah, the one thing that kind of bothers me is, we've now come to this term anecdotal evidence, and the skeptics and the debunkers use it to dismiss all the evidence. Testimony is good evidence. It in a court of law, testimony is accepted evidence. It's one chain of evidence in many UFO cases. It's one chain of evidence, but just because somebody is telling you what he saw, that does not remove it or mean it's not any good as evidence. You have to look at every case and everything that's going on so that you understand exactly what happened.
Especially when the sources are highly credible.
in a lot of the cases, they're extremely credible sources. You know, they have nothing to gain by telling their UFO story. They don't gain financially, and oftentimes there's a financial deficit that comes about because they talked about this thing publicly. You know, the best case scenario for a lot of witnesses is not to say anything at all and pretend like they didn't see it. And again, at the beginning of the Close Encounters, they've got the flight crew that is talking about the UFO, and the guy says, "Do you want to report a UFO?"
Yeah.
And the pilot says, "No, we don't want to report one of those."
Yeah.
And we've got cases where airline pilots lost their jobs or their flying status simply because they reported a UFO. There's nothing other in else in their record to suggest why they were suddenly grounded.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much. People can go to kevinrandall.blogspot.com. All of your books can also be found at Amazon. Where do you prefer they go to get your book?
Well, I like them to use Amazon, especially with the Kindle, because they could like buy it now, and it's cheaper than buying it in the bookstore, and they could like be reading it in 30 seconds, you know,
uh-huh.
It downloads immediately. And the other thing I always like, you know, I always say, if you buy my book and you like it, please write a review. If you don't like my book, write a review anyway, because I find using the reviews that the readers have written on a lot of books, even the negative ones, help me decide whether or not I want to buy a book. And a couple of negative reviews have actually convinced me this is a book I want to read.
Great.
Whether it's ufologically related or something else,
mm-hmm.
you know. And every book you write, you know, even the most popular book, Stephen King or George R. R. Martin with his Game of Thrones now, gets negative reviews. People say, "Well, I hated the book." You know.
Uh-huh.
And, well, okay, that's your opinion, but it gives you an idea of what's in the book and whether or not you might like it. So the reviews help.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I go to the negative reviews often and determine, and it's like, do I agree with what they're saying or not? And if I don't, then I'll purchase the product, whatever it may be.
Absolutely.
And you were recently speaking in Texas. Are you going to be somewhere else soon that people might be able to come meet you and talk with you and get their book signed?
Unfortunately, no. My next great trip is to Canada, where I'm filming some episodes for the Close Encounters TV program. They did their
cool.
first season, and it's just aired, and they're doing a second season now, and I get to participate in it again. So I guess I did a good enough job in the first season. I get to be in the second season as well. And that's the only other thing I have scheduled right now, which is not to say something else might later on.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the better shows to come out on this topic.
I would agree, but simply because I'm in it. So I'm biased in that respect. There's an awful lot of stuff going on. You have to, and it's like the books and everything else. You have to look at it and decide whether or not you find the material being presented in a credible way.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on again. I'm sure we'll talk again and keep in touch. And I hope everybody goes and gets your book, and it does very well.
I do too. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much to Kevin. Remember, you can check out his blog, because he's always doing various research. He's always got a lot going on. And that's at kevinrandall.blogspot.com. His blog is called A Different Perspective, because he often is bringing something new to the table. You can also see so many of his books at Amazon, because he's got, as he mentioned, tons of them. There are 3 pages of books on Amazon.com. So he's got a lot of books. Really interesting guy. So a lot of fun to talk to him. I love, of course, when people have something to add to kind of the history of how this MJ-12 stuff all came about and different perspectives. And what's great is, you know, here again, he adds mystery to the whole thing, because he feels he has evidence of conspiracy. So the conspiracy is afoot. Dun, dun, dun. So be sure to check out openminds.tv for all of this news. Also, Jason and Maureen have the web series Spacing Out, where they review all of this news on video for some of you who like to check these things out visually. So go to our YouTube to check that out. We do have a new one out this week. We have one every week right now, so we are keeping busy with that. So check out Spacing Out. Also, like Jason said, you're going to want to come to Roswell in a couple weekends for the July 4th weekend. You can watch fireworks with us, talk UFOs, have a lot of fun. A lot of our good buddies are going to be out there. Speaking of good buddies, we'll then be at MUFON, and a lot of our friends will be there. We're going to have a table, and we'll be milling about socializing and doing interviews at MUFON. We won't be speaking. However, we've got Contact in the Desert coming up, and I will be doing a talk at Contact in the Desert. So that will be a lot of fun as well. I'm putting together these talks, and they're a lot of fun. I mean, in Roswell, I'm doing one on ETs and religion, how they've affected religion, and how they're creating new religions. And then also talking about all the official government UFO organizations out there and how they got created, because, you know, these people don't get into UFOs for the heck of it. They've had some incredible cases that they feel justify these organizations. So we talk about that as well. So that'll be a lot of fun. You can read more about that at openminds.tv on the events page. However, the event of the year is, of course, always the International UFO Congress. That's right, folks. And you can now register for that for the early bird special. You'll get in there for $199. Many of these events I've spoken about, you won't be able to even look in the direction of the conference. We're at $199. And ours is longer and very good. Not to say anything bad about any others. But the UFO Congress is the best because that's where a lot of researchers go. We have over 20 people. The researchers are talking. You can go hang out with them. You can go have a beer with them. You can go gamble with them at the casino. You can, I've seen people, I don't drink alcohol. But for those of you who do, I've even seen people getting a little tipsy with the speakers. And, of course, they have a lot of fun doing that. So, yeah, party it up with or without alcohol at the UFO Congress. And it's a lot of fun. And, of course, what we're there for is information, and you will get a ton of information. So, again, you can go to openminds.tv or ufocongress.com to register. I would recommend you register and reserve your hotel ASAP because, as I tell you guys, those rooms go quick. And you want to be in the host hotel if you can. It's a lot more fun. I mean, there's a lot of close hotels at good deals. So check that out. Otherwise, I think I've talked about everything I needed to update you on. I do, as usual, want to thank the gentleman who creates our open and close music, Caleb Hanks. You can go to theclerkchronicles.com to download his music for free. It's awesome. It's good stuff. I'm always getting compliments on our open and closed music. So let's cue the closed music and let's get out of here. Adios, muchachos. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.